This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The North Carolina legislature stayed up late last night. The House reconvened this morning. They're finished with their legislative session. The Senate finished its business early this morning. Dave DeWitt is with us. He's been covering the legislature this past week. He's our Raleigh Bureau Chief. We're also going to talk with legislative journalists who've covered this session. Tim Boyum is the host of Capitol Tonight on News 14. And Bob Geary is a freelance journalist. For the Independent Weekly, Tim Boyum and Bob Geary, welcome to the State of Things, as well as you, Dave. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi.
Thank you.
Dave, tell us about the last bills and what has passed, some of the key legislation that crossed the desk and finished this session in the wee small hours of the morning.
Well, last night, I guess early this morning, as you correctly pointed out, the Senate adjourned, but not before taking on some of the bills that were sort of left out there, including abortion and voting rights and things like that. Not a lot of drama in those votes. We knew what the end result was going to be. There was a lot of energy and heat in the room, a lot of people arguing and disagreeing. But, you know, it was interesting because while people did disagree vehemently at times, right at the end of the session, Martin Nesbitt, who really enjoyed getting up a couple different times during the last week telling the Republican leadership that voters were coming for them. That remains to be seen. He did say at the end, he appreciated the leadership of the Senate giving full time for debate. So there wasn't a lot of calling the question, they say. There wasn't a lot of time that they weren't going to have the debates that they were going to have. And then this morning, it was sort of a couple of small bills the House was going to clean up. But one of the more interesting ones dealt with the 16 and 17-year-olds who commit misdemeanors being moved to the juvenile court system. They're now, North Carolina is one of only two states that handles those cases in the adult system. And we really didn't know the outcome of that one because it was a very close vote. Actually, it wasn't a close vote, but because of procedures, it was a lot of Republicans. It was a Republican-sponsored bill. A lot of Republicans voted for that. Some didn't. But because of legislative rules, it would have taken another day and another reading. And that wasn't going to happen. They were going to adjourn today, but there was a suspension of rules motion, and that didn't pass. But it was interesting to see, for once, a lot of question about what the end result was going to be, because a lot of these bigger bills, there was no question.
Now, tell us a little bit about the voter ID bill. We saw that Attorney General Roy Cooper today urged Governor McCrory to veto that bill that he says simply places undue restrictions on voting in North Carolina. It's on its way to the governor. Tell us about it.
Well, it's not only getting attention here in this state, but it's getting a lot of national attention. And Eric Holder, in a speech earlier this week, he's the the U.S. Attorney General, said that his office is going to start more aggressively going after states that enact more restrictive voting laws. He's going to start in Texas, but he's coming for North Carolina. And there's a lot of question, of course, after the Supreme Court struck down parts of the Voting Rights Act, what is going to happen and how it'll go into the courts. But he looks like he's willing to make North Carolina one of the first he's going for. And so, this is a little bit of politics. Roy Cooper is a Democrat, and he's not somebody who wants to get up and support these kinds of bills, or laws now. So he did. It was interesting. He made that comment. He's asking the governor. The governor's got a press conference this afternoon. We'll see what he says.
Nearly laws. We're still waiting for the governor to sign. And there's an abortion bill on his desk. What's going to happen with that? Tell us what was the final package and what will happen with it.
Well, as it made its way through the process, the governor did weigh in. Of course, while he was a candidate, he said he would not sign any bill that restricts a woman's right to choose. And then, this bill popped up. He made some comments. He worked a little bit with the legislature, got it tamped down just a little bit. But it still is. These are restrictions that will make it more challenging for women who seek abortions to get those abortions, and it make more challenging for clinics to be able to operate in this state. So if he signs that bill, I think most people would say he's going against a promise he made as a candidate. Now, that's not a rare thing for candidates to do. But it's a pretty drastic change for him, and I'm sure he'll get questions about that today as well.
Tim Boyum, let me ask you about this session. You've been covering politics in the state for quite a while and the legislature for a while. How has this session compared with others from your point of view?
Well, it's been fundamental change, a 180 in state politics. So that by itself means that, we're in new territory basically in this state, 140 years since Republicans have had this much control. So not only are we having to get adjusted to a new way of governing this state, but they're taking on things like Medicaid, unemployment, insurance, and tax reform that are incredibly challenging and complex. On top of that, we're getting more spin than ever. So in those ways, it's made it incredibly difficult.
Are you surprised at the velocity of the change or in this just one session?
No. you know, you never know how long you're going to have that power.
Yeah.
And we see the reactions, so you never know how long it might last. But I made this point the other day, you know, it all seems so controversial and it's all over national politics. But the truth is, they told us they were going to do all of this. So in the end, really, they're just doing what they were going to do in the first place. So we really shouldn't be all that surprised.
Bob Geary, what do you make of it? I know you've been spending some time on Halifax Mall as well as covering the inside. What's going on inside?
I have. I agree that we knew or we should have known what the Republican agenda would be. But I am surprised that they have not been more careful about rolling it out. They've acted like they only had 6 months to get everything done that they ever wanted to do. And in fact, they have 4 years at least, and with the gerrymandered districts in this state that they drew up, they really have 10 years. So it struck me that they could have been more responsible appearing, taken more time, been more careful about things. I'm surprised that they rejected Medicaid expansion. I think if they'd taken a little time with that, they would have realized that that's billions of dollars that the healthcare industry in this state wanted, that they should have allowed to come in. There was really no reason to reject it. But they rushed to an ideological decision about that and many other things. I think they've been reckless in the way they've used their power. And as a result, out in the streets, people are rallying. I think we can thank the Republicans for the fact that the opposition is taking form.
Tim Boyme, I know that paying attention to social media is something that now we're all assigned to do. So you're in touch with your viewers and perhaps in a way that you hadn't been before. Are they, do you think, more engaged with what's happening now in the state legislature than they had been?
Yeah, there's no question. And one of the most interesting ways to follow that is this abortion bill. You have Nero Pro-Choice and Planned Parenthood on there calling for women to come to the state capitol. And to see the retweets and the follows, it is insane, frankly, how much that is playing an impact on how much people are following politics. And I get viewer comments nonstop all day long.
Dave, is there a pattern to some of what's happened in the legislature? You know, I'm thinking about local control. There were a lot of bills that spoke directly to taking control, say, from, let's say, the Wake County School Board and giving it to county commission on real estate, right? Clearly an effort to take it out of the hands of Democrats, put it in the hands of Republicans. That one failed. On the other hand, there's the 751 issue in the annexation in Durham, and that one passed, and that clearly just helped developers over and against the will of the people of Durham. A legislator from Eastern North Carolina says, yeah, give the developer the right to go in and do what the people of Durham said they didn't want, and that one passed. Is there kind of a rhyme or reason for, you know, questions like local control for one?
No. The granddaddy of all those is the Charlotte Airport situation, which last night was as heated as any debate I think we'd seen all week. Which is a perfect example of this legislature getting involved in a very local fight. And they, if you'll remember, the legislature originally had a bill to take away the airport from the city of Charlotte, make a regional authority. They did that. The city of Charlotte got an injunction, a court injunction against that. So then the legislature came back with a hastily crafted bill to sort of address that whole situation. And it had people, not only the legislators from Mecklenburg County and the areas around, but everybody else would sort of chime in and say, well, if we pass this, what's to stop the state legislature from doing something in my community or in this little community? And you'd see people who would make that comment and then vote for something that's not in their community and then vote against something that is in their community. So there is no rhyme or reason to that. You think the more the legislature does it, the more they're going to see these kinds of bills pop up before them.
Even conservative ideology, we expect the Republicans and conservatives to be more restrictive on abortion. We expect conservatives to cut people off unemployment insurance and cut them off of Medicaid. It's their own fault. Let them fix it. Don't make me pay for it. That's the conservative mantra, conservative ideology. People at the lower end of the spectrum need to fix themselves. Don't put it on us. And then you see this legislation last minute that is also a part of the conservative agenda, and it seems to go in reverse, not charging 16 and 17-year-olds as adults, soft on crime. We don't want to change that, and yet it's a Republican measure. What do you think is behind that?
Well, I would just say, you know, you asked about ideology, and you asked, I mean, this is a perfect example. If you were a 16 and 17-year-old, this was not a good legislature for you, because not only are you going to remain in a court system for adults, but they also told you in the voting rights bill that you're too confused to understand that you can't vote until you're 18, so we can't pre-register you. And there's that is not an ideological strain that goes through that. That's treating 16 and 17-year-olds dramatically different from bill to bill, and that, you know, that happens from bill to bill. Everybody gets treated differently.
Dave DeWitt, WUNC Raleigh Bureau Chief. Tim Boehm is host of Capital Tonight on News 14 Carolina. Bob Geary, freelance journalist with The Independent Weekly. We'll talk more about this last session of the North Carolina Legislature when our program continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Dave DeWitt is with us, our Raleigh Bureau Chief. Tim Boehm is host of Capital Tonight on News 14 Carolina. Bob Geary, a freelance journalist with The Independent Weekly. And joining us now is Laura Leslie, Capital Bureau Chief for WRAL-TV. Laura, welcome.
Hello.
I want to. You sound awfully chipper for somebody who's up late last night and
caffeine is magic.
Early in the morning. Well, soon you can rest. But before you do, let me ask you about this piece of legislation that's fairly interesting. We talked about the possible legal challenges, the Justice Department threatening to challenge states that have made voter ID, voting more restrictive. That means that North Carolina could be in its sights, and that means that the AG, the Attorney General of the state of North Carolina, would have to defend the state. He is a Democrat, and it appears that the legislature, the Republican-led legislature, has thought about that and passed legislation that might put them in a position to defend the state should Roy Cooper decide he didn't want to be too vigorous. Tell us about that bill.
Yeah, it was one of the darndest things, bills. It showed up at, I don't know, maybe 11:30 last night. Had never been discussed, that I know of, at least in a committee in either the House or Senate here. This provision was attached to a bill that had to do with health care. It had nothing to do with it. And basically what it says is that if the Speaker and the President pro tem join together as a team, then they will have standing to intervene on behalf of the General Assembly as a party in any judicial proceeding challenging a law or a provision of the Constitution. Now, as you know, it's the Attorney General's job normally to defend the state's laws or the state's Constitution. In court, they're sort of supposed to be the voice of the state representing the state. What this says is the legislature would have an equal standing to the Attorney General to intervene in legal matters. That is very interesting in light of some things that have happened around same-sex marriage bans lately. You may have heard that AGs in Pennsylvania, I think New Mexico and California, and I think a couple other states, have refused to defend their state's same-sex marriage bans, saying that they were unconstitutional. Well, we have already been told that North Carolina is going to be targeted, its same-sex marriage ban is going to be targeted for a federal case. And so I think they're lining things up so that if the Attorney General chooses not to defend it, that they would automatically have the standing to defend it on their own.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, nobody on this panel is a lawyer, but I wonder if a court has to recognize the standing. I mean, that's the first thing the court does. Do you have standing before this court to do what it is you say you want to do? For instance, defend a state. Attorney generals have that by guideline. I wonder if you can just legislate your way into that little tent.
Well, as a lawyer friend of mine said, asserting standing does not make it so.
I would say not.
Yeah. And this does raise some really interesting questions about separation of powers, right? I mean, we have three branches of government that do different things for different reasons. But it is, you know, it is something to remember that, for example, in the Prop 8 case that the Supreme Court recently ruled on, they sent it back to the lower court and let it stand because they said the people who brought the case to defend Prop 8 did not have standing. So, I mean, it is a really it can be a really critical point in a lawsuit, you know. But as you pointed out with the voting rights, for example, Voting Rights Act and our voter ID election changes we just passed, it could be really critical for that, too. I just got a press release from AG Cooper's office urging the governor to veto that bill that legislature just spent 2 days, 3 days passing, you know. And so there's, I think, a whole array of ideological positions on which, you know, the legislators and the AG may find themselves to be in opposition.
Well, and this bill does say that the president pro tem, currently Phil Berger, and the House Speaker, currently Tom Tillis, would have to stand together, which, Tim, didn't always happen this session. tell us about the way the Republican fractures showed up once they had power.
Well, the one thing we should say first is there's always fractures no matter who's in charge. The Democrats had plenty of fractures of their own. But I do think this was different because we really haven't seen this, as we mentioned, for over 100 years. Part of it, I think, goes back to the governor not picking a lot of people with state government experience. You know, his secretaries are all mainly from the private sector. Even, you know, under those folks, there's not a lot of state government experience. So they were learning, and it was a huge learning curve. And then the Senate really just had their own minds this session. They wanted to do what they wanted to do. They didn't seem to care at times what the governor wanted to do. So, you know, much like a family trying to get along, it's not always easy to get into the same car and on the same highway to the same destination.
I would add to that, too, that one thing that complicated it this year even more so, two things, actually. Number one, both McCrory and Tillis are from Charlotte, right? And then you've got Berger, who is from Rockingham, Eden, you know, up north of the Triad. And Tillis and McCrory were widely perceived to be working much more closely together than Berger. So the Senate often found itself, or felt itself at least, to be sort of the odd man out in that sort of triangle of power. The other really interesting point is that, of course, we know that Speaker Tillis is planning to run for U.S. Senate in 2014. Senator Berger has not said he will for sure, but of course he's doing a lot of things that look a lot like he's going to, you know, and he's going to make that announcement pretty soon. So there was an extra layer of sort of political, bigger political ambition that was adding to a lot of the normal fractures, as Tim pointed out. It's not unusual to have these sort of schisms within caucuses and parties, but this added a whole new layer to the standard kind of inter-chamber fights that you tend to see.
And Bob Gary, you say you noticed the rural-urban split as well.
Well, I think you have a series of bills, the Charlotte Airport bill, the bill taking control of the Asheville water system. There was another bill to tear up the Dorothea Dix lease in Raleigh, and several others where legislators from rural areas, Republican legislators, without a lot of experience, I think, they rushed in for whatever reason, I think in some cases grudges, and they wanted to take power away from a city that is under Democratic control. I don't think it's really any more complicated than that. But, for example, in the case of the Charlotte Airport, they passed a bill, created an authority, stripped the city of control over the airport, and then realized, wait a minute, this airport has bond obligations that the state treasurer tried to tell us about, but we didn't listen to her. And yesterday they were scrambling around to pass another bill to make up for the bad bill they passed in the first place. It was really pretty bad.
Well, and wait a minute seems to be one of the themes in this legislature. A lot of legislation that got passed. Dave DeWitt, let me start with you on this one. The Medicaid legislation, you know, if we'd waited just a little bit, the state could have had that federal money and still found itself sort of in the same position it is just a few months later. How much of it do you think, how much of what happened this year, is sort of founded on a little bit of inexperience and not having full hearings? There may have been debate on the floor, but what about the hearing process and the sort of the research process that goes into legislation?
Yeah, a little bit of ready, fire, aim, I think, sort of showed up in a lot of the bills. And, you know, you could say that about the gun bill. You know, the timing on that was probably not the best, considering what happened in Connecticut and other places. So, you know, a lot of those bills, and you mentioned Medicaid, there are a couple of others. And then I think you saw a lot of veteran lawmakers really craft some good bills. We were talking a little bit about the juvenile court, 16 and 17-year-olds. There's some bills there that were really well-crafted.
that then some folks who maybe were somewhat new to the legislature would sort of look for some direction on and didn't know really how to vote on these kinds of things, would you know, got pressured a lot by sheriffs and got pressured a lot by some of the DAs back home. That was a, like I said, I thought that was a really interesting debate this morning and played into some of that sort of newness versus people who've been here a little bit and whether that ideology was going to drive you or whether you're going to step back and sort of, okay, what does this mean and how should we play with this?
Tim, you talked about Governor McCrory appointing people who didn't have much experience in government, and he has been a mayor, and we haven't heard a lot from him. I mean, has he been sort of following the lead? What kind of a leadership role has he played?
When I've interviewed him, he's never wanted to talk about anything except for transportation reform, commerce reform, and tax reform.
And
he even called in one of the interviews I did with him. He called abortion a side issue. So he wanted to focus on those things and nothing else, and not get distracted, as he said, quote. But what he found out quickly is that you're the governor of all of North Carolina, not just Charlotte or some reform plans you want to do.
Laura,
I was just going to say, I think his mistake so far has been to be a mayor. He's very dedicated and very focused on fixing things, right? But what he hasn't done is set an agenda. And in this town, if you don't set an agenda, lots of people are ready to set one for you. Mm-hmm. And he walked into, a legislature in which Tillotsenberger had already been in power for 2 years and really didn't have any particular desire to share that. Without sort of taking a strong, agenda-setting stance and being out there and being vocal about things, he sort of relegated himself, to the back bench while these guys have been largely running the show and the agenda for the party in the state.
Is that something that he has to change, or can he let it go on like that? Because the other thing is that there's sort of a plausible deniability. He has to run in the whole state. He does not have a gerrymandered district that might be as conservative as some of the legislation that was passed. Does he like this sort of thing? Is it helpful to him?
Well, it depends on which polls you look at. Some polls seem to show that his popularity has been slipping as the legislature has sort of been, ramping up over the last few weeks. But, he has agreed to and has signed a lot of the bills that a lot of people thought might be a little bit too conservative for him. So, you have to remember, though, he is faced with a legislature in which both chambers have veto-proof majorities. So, and the loyalty of the folks in those chambers is more likely with the leaders of those chambers than with the governor. So, should he push something to a veto and an override, he stands a very good chance of losing. And at that point, he really would pretty much become irrelevant, much as Bev Perdue was.
I do think messaging has been interesting, too, because, Governor McCrory's had his slip-ups, and now he's facing this abortion issue with a question that actually Laura asked during the debate. The Senate just doesn't seem to care what people think, and they're just going to do what they want. They don't care about PR. Tillis is concerned about his Senate image. Take the tax issue. If they would have just called it a tax cut, they knew the left would be upset, the Republicans would love it, and more of the headlines would have been about a tax plan. Instead, we're all debating whether it was reform for 3 days afterwards. I think there was a lot of messaging issues.
I think McCrory is, frankly, over his head. When he was in Charlotte, Charlotte is a strong manager, weak mayor form of government, as every city in North Carolina is. And McCrory had a Democratic city council. He had a strong manager. He had a strong chamber of commerce with moderate corporate leadership. And he followed what was a consensus view of how Charlotte should grow. He's not used to setting an agenda. And I think I watched him campaign twice for governor. He has very little curiosity about issues. So he came to this office after having run for it for 6 years, knowing almost nothing about state government. And it's really showing.
I wonder about what you make of this issue of that we read about today. It appears that the head of the Department of Public Safety has resigned, right, Kieran Shanahan, under a cloud. There have been some questions about whether there were possible conflicts of interest. Laura Leslie, let me ask you about that resignation and its implications.
Well, the rumors started flying last night, but it wasn't until this morning that we were able to confirm it. And according to Mr. Shanahan's letter, the reasons that he is resigning is that his wife has received a promotion, is going to be stationed in Virginia, and it's proving more challenging, as he said, to sort of keep his business interests to be separate, both of which sound pretty good on the face of things. But when you look at the fact that he has given the governor of the state 1 week notice that he is leaving his job over two things that are not exactly spur-of-the-moment events. There's clearly more here.
And what are the questions that are because there have been some questions surrounding possible conflict of interest and his lobbying activities while he was director of public safety?
I would not even want to try to speculate
on
that, because I think, I mean, clearly something happened and happened pretty quickly. I don't know whether we'll find out more about it. I know a lot of reporters are trying to right now. So
I wouldn't be surprised either if he's not the only one that leaves for whatever reason. I think a lot of these people came in, wanted to change government. Now that it's changed somewhat, there'll be other people coming. There's a lot of speculation whether Art Pope will stay on, his budget director. I know a lot of people that thought he should have been his legislative liaison, may have been more of an arm twister at the legislature. But I think there's a great question whether he stays on. So a lot of folks came on to help him and to change North Carolina. Now that they've done a lot of that already, I think we might see some others leave too.
Kieran,
well,
I don't know.
There's always that issue.
Dave?
I'm sorry. There's always a, you know, early on, he was part of the situation who appointed Diana Lightfoot as part of the, you know, the childhood development, early education. And she's somebody who hadn't really been properly vetted. And she made a lot of comments in her past that were pretty negative and were pretty, anti-child development in a way. So, you know, there's a bit of a pattern about not doing due diligence. And I think it gets back to what a lot of other folks have said here about he hasn't run a big state government. He didn't come from this. And these kinds of appointments were pretty new to him. And he didn't have an establishment in place where he could pull from.
What about the Moral Monday protest? Are they going to have him? That's been the big question all the way through from the moment they began, whether or not they're going to have an impact, whether or not the legislature has to pay attention to them at all. And if they don't, what could be the impact? Bob Geary?
Well, I think the legislature is not paying attention to them, and I think maybe they should have, because what's being said out in the streets is true to the extent that anything is true. These folks are making good points about the unemployed, about Medicaid, about schools. And I think it would behoove the Republicans to stop and think and be careful about what they're doing, but they're not listening. And as a consequence of that, the Moral Mondays are gaining momentum. There have been 12, I think every one but one when it rained pretty hard, has been bigger than the last. I think the next one next Monday will be bigger, the biggest of all. And it will start to translate into election activity.
Laura?
I was just going to argue that actually I think it – I don't know how much actual effect it's had on legislation, because I think that'd be difficult to quantify. But I can tell you it really is bugging folks down here. I have had so many Republican lawmakers come up to me and sort of complain and say, I don't know why you're even covering these protests and what do these people want. And they're paying attention to it. They don't like it. They may not understand it, but they are clearly aware that there are people who are unhappy. But they feel strongly that they have a mandate from the electorate that put them in overwhelmingly in 2012. And they feel like these folks out here are the voice of a minority, but the folks who support them are the folks who are at home and they believe will vote them back in 2014. I do think there's one thing I think might have changed because of them. They were initially talking about some other, even more sort of radical changes to voting laws. One of them would be to get rid of Sunday voting. You might remember that. That did not show up in the voting omnibus. They eliminated one Sunday of early voting, but they did not ban Sunday voting altogether. And I think that may have been a direct response to some of the NAACP actions that we've seen.
Ken?
I think the question of the impact, we won't know until the fall of 2014. I mean, protesters are always louder. You know, they always say that, you know, we don't know. There's, 1,600 people there every week. That is a decent amount of people, but we have, 6 million voters in the state, so we don't know on that front. I think it's been successful to bring national attention. We've seen CNN and MSNBC and other stations here. But a larger question of whether it will have an impact at the polls, I think, remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, Bob, 40-plus percent of the population could get out there and say, I didn't vote for you. I'm mad at you. And they can say, well, yeah, 50-plus did, and so they're not here because they're happy.
Well, Democrats have an uphill battle because of the gerrymandered districts, but it is really not true that the Republicans had a big mandate out of the 2012 elections. They got about half the votes, but because of the way the districts are drawn, they got two-thirds of the seats. It'll be hard to win a lot of them back, but some of those elections were pretty close. So they could lose 7 or 8 seats in the House, a couple, 3 seats in the Senate, if there's any movement at all. And I think there's quite a bit of movement out there.
Laura, let me ask you, the Republicans may or may not be taking anything out of these protests. Are the Democrats taking a tip?
You know, the Democrats here really haven't sort of gelled this session. I don't know if that's a problem at the state level or a problem at the caucus level. I think they're, you know, sort of madly scrambling to figure out how to be relevant, how to be, you know, how to work with the majority when possible here. But, I mean, you know, we have not seen a real sort of organized, I think last night during the voting rights, the election changes bill, the voter ID bill, they all stood up and sort of did a symbolic holding of hands and prayer on the floor as the bill was voted through by the Republican majority. But that's sort of the first thing you've seen like that yet this session. So I don't know whether it's going to inspire them or energize them. I know a lot of people have got to be hoping that it will inspire and energize Democratic voters, but, you know, that election is a long way off.
Tim?
I know a lot of Democrats behind the scenes in the political side of things, they're looking for one Democrat to rally behind. And I know a lot of them are looking for a candidate for governor that might even be willing to start running next year. It's a long campaign, but they need somebody to rally behind. Right now, they're rallying behind probably a dozen different people.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Tim Boehm, host of Capital Tonight on News 14 Carolina. Laura Leslie, Capital Bureau Chief at WRAL-TV. Dave DeWitt, WNC's Raleigh Bureau Chief. And Bob Geary, a freelance journalist for The Independent Weekly. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up next, the music of the love language. Please stay tuned.